Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we explore the ways in which we can and must power down in a new era, no longer exploiting our fellow humans and ecosystems.
We believe in building up our community resilience, expecting further economic collapse in the face of abrupt climate change, the end of cheap oil, the depletion of our natural resources, and a possible mass extinction on our planet. I'm Bing Gong.
And I'm Bernie Steffen, and today we're talking about how much longer can this world sustain our growing population. We'll be taking a sobering look at our population, how various cultures are approaching this issue.
Our guest today is Alan Weissman, author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. That's a question mark. His previous book, The World Without Us, was a critically acclaimed New York Times bestseller. Alan Weissman is an award-winning journalist whose reports have appeared in many publications, and he's appeared on National Public Radio. Formerly a contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine, Alan is also a radio producer for Homelands Production. He teaches journalism at the University of Arizona and lives in Western Massachusetts. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Alan, we're really lucky that you're here. It's a great book that you've authored, and I want to start off by asking you, you know, how did you come to take on this subject of population? Many people have viewed it as taboo, as something that is too religious.
Well, a lot of your listeners probably remember my last book, The World Without Us, which became kind of a phenomenon. It's out in 34 languages now. If they don't know it, the only important thing is to understand that I wrote that book not because I want a world without humans, but I would like one with us. The idea was theoretically clear us off the planet, see what nature would do if it wasn't beset by the daily pressures that we heap on it, and it turns out that nature has tremendous resilience and would recover rather splendidly, as it has done after other extinctions that were perpetrated not by our particular race, but by various geologic phenomena. And at the end, you know, I was hoping that readers would come away with the idea of, wow, that's so beautiful. Is there some way that we could restore ourselves to that picture of nature revived, only this time in harmony with the rest of the planet and not in what appears to be mortal combat?
So you took that feedback seriously.
Yeah, but in the course of my research for the epilogue for that book, in which I wanted to discuss how we might do that, I ran into a rather disturbing figure. And that is, every 4.5 days we're adding 1 million people to the planet. And there's just no way that that could possibly be sustainable. So at the end of The World Without Us, I ended up doing another thought experiment, setting all social considerations aside for the moment. What would happen if we all participated in the Chinese policy of just one child per family? And a demographic institute, very distinguished one in Vienna, crunched the numbers for me. And it turns out that by the end of this century, our population would be back to about 1.6 billion, which was exactly the population of the world in the year 1900, before suddenly we doubled and then doubled again. We quadrupled in a single century for reasons, you know, that I go into in this book, Countdown. Well, you know, that would give a lot of breathing room for us and for other species. And yet, you know, nobody likes the Chinese policy. Nevertheless, not even the Chinese. I mean, nevertheless, I found that whenever I talked about that book, and I've given hundreds of talks about it, readers always went back to that. They wanted to know, well, is there something that we could really do about it? But as you said, for reasons of religion and economics and politics, it's a loaded question. It's also loaded for reasons of human instincts. I mean, like any other organism, we are designed to make copies of ourselves and to refrain from doing something so natural. And it just feels exactly that. It just doesn't feel natural at all. about how are we going to solve any environmental problem with this many people on the planet. So being a journalist, I figured that I should take a stab at looking at population not as someone who is pro-population control or against population control, but as dispassionately as possible using the tools of journalism to test all the different opinions about it. And the result was much more complicated than I'd planned on. I ended up going to 21 countries, and at the end of this book, there's almost 3/4 of an inch of bibliography. But
do you mind if right now we take a look at some of those countries that you visited? Because it's, I think, very informative to understand how this is not the same problem everywhere. It looks quite differently in different countries.
Well, I would say that it is the same problem everywhere, because no matter where human beings are, they're adding to the problem. Even in poor countries, we've kind of changed the concept of original sin over the last century. Everybody needs shelter. Everybody needs fuel, whether it's firewood or fossil fuels. Everybody needs land and to grow food. And right now, there are so many of us on this planet that 40% of the non-frozen land is devoted to feeding us, either through cultivation or through grazing.
Look,
I started the book in Israel and Palestine, which
yeah.
is an example of the extremes to where this thing could go. You know, here you got these two people, each one trying to be the majority in a country that most of which is really a sandbox. Before the state of Israel was created, it was under British rule, and the British ecologist calculated that the carrying capacity of it was about 2.5 million people. David Ben-Gurion, the Zionist who became the first Israeli prime minister, argued that Jewish ingenuity could make the desert bloom, and he was convinced that even twice that, you know, up to 6 million people could fit there. Well, today there are close to 12 million people between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, and by the middle of the century at the present rate, there are going to be 21 million people.
And this competition between the Palestinians and the Israelis, I don't think many people have understood this. I certainly haven't had it. When we hear about the conflict and the competition for the land and the politics and all, but the trying to up your numbers is either conscious or unconscious part of what's going on there.
Well, it's something that that you find in the history of nearly all cultures and religions on the face of the earth. The whole idea of being fruitful and multiply is always there.
Yeah, and
when you read Genesis, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were all polygamists for the same reason that the Mormons were later on. It's a strategy to have a lot of children as fast as you can so you are more powerful than your neighbors. You know, they wanted to be able to outcompete the Canaanites, and that's what Genesis is all about. Fortunately, though, you know, you get down to the fourth generation, and that's when one of Jacob's 13 children, Jacob had four wives, one of his 13 children, Joseph, was born. And Joseph really leaves us with a very, very interesting story, because he was quite observant. I sometimes think he may have been history's first recorded ecologist, because he realized that there are times when the earth enters into cycles of scarcity. So he only has one wife and two children, and he consults the Pharaoh of Egypt and the Israelites that, you know, as it says in Ecclesiastes, that there are times to refrain from embracing so much. It was a time not to keep expanding, but a time to conserve, because it was a time of urgency in order to save themselves, which they did, and I sometimes think that we're in another one of those times.
Yeah, and, you know, early on, the survival rate was not what we have now. Now, almost every child born survives, but in those days, wasn't part of the strategy of being with many children is so that you would be assured to be able to carry on that that gene?
Yeah. You know, I mentioned that, like every other organism, we're designed to make copies of ourselves. We're actually designed to make extra copies of ourselves. So does every other species.
Right.
Because the infant mortality rate in nature is very high. But beginning in at the end of the 18th century, 1796, a vaccine for smallpox was developed, and that was followed by more vaccines and the discovery of antiseptic and the need for hygiene in hospitals, pasteurization of milk. All this stuff happened, and suddenly, unlike before, when most babies were dead by their fifth birthday, infant mortality plummeted. Babies were surviving, which seemed like a lovely thing, of course, and also people were living longer. And by at 1800, the life expectancy of human beings was 40 years, and today it's almost double that. So that means in both directions, population started to increase quite a bit. And we passed a billion, and then we got up to 1.6 billion at the dawn of the 20th century, and then everything else changed enormously for the second big reason why our population is so big now.
Well, some of the countries you visited, like Pakistan, are quite overpopulated in terms of the area that they hold and how many people are living there. Comment a little bit about what you observed.
Right. Well, that brings us to the second big reason why human population exploded twice in the 20th century. The first one was right around World War One when we invented artificial nitrogen fertilizer. Before, the amount of plant life on the planet was limited to what a relatively few plants could contribute to the soil, plants that had nitrogen-fixing bacteria in their roots. You know, if it wasn't for nitrogen fertilizer, 40% of us would not be alive.
And that was called the Green Revolution?
No,
not yet.
The Green Revolution. We're getting there.
Okay.
To explain about Pakistan.
Yeah.
What happened then is that populations just about, you know, nearly tripled. By the middle of the 1960s, there were 3.5 billion people on the planet, and so many that, as Malthus had predicted, starvation was running ahead of food production. But that's when the Green Revolution came about, which was a miracle in genetic breeding that allowed grains, corn and rice and wheat particularly, to produce many more grains per stalk. And at the time, Pakistan and India were just about to collapse in a horrible famine. The Green Revolution crops saved the day there, and the famines did not occur. And today, many people believe that Malthus and then Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who wrote a book called The Population Bomb, who said that the Malthusian crisis was imminent. They wrote that back in 1968. They say that, you know, the Green Revolution completely refuted that. What they forget was that the founder of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize, he's credited for saving more lives than anybody in history, said that the battle against hunger had not been solved. It had been postponed for a generation.
Yeah.
And unless population growth or population control were combined with enhanced food production, there was going to be a terrible crisis. So let's look at Pakistan and India today. India is about to surpass China as the most populous nation on Earth, because as Borlaug understood, the more babies, it's a paradox that when you give people food, instead of dying of hunger, they live to produce more people who live to have more babies, and so hunger always stays one step ahead. Pakistan today has nearly 200 million people in a country the size of Texas, and by the middle of the century, if it keeps going the way it will, it is right now, it'll have nearly 400 million people. That's many more than the entire United States, and it'll still be the size of Texas. And its economy can't possibly keep up with employing them all, so it's a country filled with frustrated, angry, under or unemployed young men who then become a breeding ground for what many people in the United States term as terrorists today.
Alan, I want to come back to something that's so important that I think you talked about here clearly, is that in our effort to save lives, which we think that millions and billions of people starving, that's the catastrophe, that's the problem. In our efforts to solve that using the technology of the nitrogen and then the Green Revolution techniques, we've created a different crisis, and that crisis is overpopulation. The overpopulation is partly there because of our efforts to try to prevent starvation.
Well, look, it's almost a universal truth that technology, which basically is a way of concentrating and intensifying natural processes through mechanical means or artificial means, it produces incredible results, but it also always produces some unintended consequences. Both medical technology and food technology resulted in population explosions that now have created, really, we are living in the most abnormal population explosion in the history of biology. I mean, there's a few cases of microbes that we know that have had huge blooms, but anything bigger than that, this is unprecedented.
Normally, nature corrects sooner than this situation.
Yeah, it's because, we have remained technologically proficient. But, a lot of people say that, well, that's just going to keep going on. We're going to keep solving these problems through human ingenuity. But the fact is that we are running out of space and resources to keep solving them.
Plus, the fact with climate change and extreme weather, that's not helping at all either.
Well, I was just going to explain that. I mean, two of the results of the Green Revolution have to do with water shortages and then climate change. India, which, drilled all these wells to water all these Green Revolution crops, the wells used to be about, 50 feet deep, and now they go down 500 and 1,000 feet in. So this is a startling statistic, but when I was there, and I confirmed this with the Indian government, I learned first in the Punjab Farm Union that since 1995, 270,000 Green Revolution Indian farmers have committed suicide because they could no longer afford to keep drilling and pumping so deeply. And they do it symbolically by drinking pesticide. And, of course, pesticide is another one, in the poisons from that, is another one of the unintended consequences because the plants of the Green Revolution didn't develop in nature, and they didn't evolve with their own natural defenses, so we need to use artificial defenses to protect them, meaning poison, and unfortunately poisons aren't as selective as we'd like to think. And then as for greenhouse gases, well, we are the reason that they have elevated above pre-industrial revolution levels. We get in nature buried a whole bunch of surplus energy that it didn't need. But in the last 250 years, we've dug up, millions and millions and millions worth of fossilized plants, and we've burned them to jet propel our society. But as a result, there's now more carbon dioxide up in the atmosphere than there has been in 3 million years. And 3 million years ago, the seas were I'm thinking in meters because I just came back from Europe, but the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher than they are today. And 15 million years ago, the same thing. Now, volcanism was probably the main cause of those two intensifications of carbon dioxide, but this time we're the volcano.
Yeah. Wow. You moved into we were talking about Pakistan and India, and you talk about the Philippines, too. What did you view there?
Well, one of the things that I did in the research for this book, and that started in Israel and Palestine, was talking to religious authorities. One reason was to find, is there anything in the history of the liturgies that might permit the idea of, as I said before, refraining from embracing so much, and I gave you that example from Genesis. However, even though I found things in virtually every religion, including Islam, including Buddhism, that could permit the use of contraception, which basically takes an extremist position among Christian churches. Now, they don't have very much power anymore. The Vatican used to be a middle-sized European city, but they lost a European country. They lost all their land except for 110 acres, which is Vatican City today. But they do have power over just a couple of countries in the world, and the Philippines is one of them. The Philippines, the bishops pride themselves as being more Catholic than the Pope. There's a suburb of Manila where you can get thrown in jail for 6 months if you buy condoms without a prescription. There's no national family planning program. The Philippines has had an enormous population explosion. It's quintupled alone, in less than a century. And one of the reasons I went there, though, is to show that population groups, and particularly and ecologists coming together, are working an end run around the government, because 90% of the protein in a Filipino's diet comes from fish. So all these fishing communities around the islands have begun their own local family planning programs, because the fishermen have come to understand that they need to remain in balance with fish stocks. And we're talking about an area that has the highest marine biodiversity of any part of the world. And yet, humans were starting to completely wipe out entire species. So now that's being corrected to a certain extent, because more and more fishing villages have, realized that if each family produces 9 kids and 5 of them are males and they become fishermen, they're going to run out of supplies. Unfortunately, with rising seas, a lot of those villages are now threatened. So the question is, who's going to win this race?
Wow. You also went to Africa, Alan, specifically in Uganda and Niger, which has the world's highest fertility rate. What were your observations?
Well, let me take those in the order that you mentioned them. Uganda is kind of a terrestrial analog to the Philippines. Uganda is a country that has incredibly high biodiversity, including the world's largest population of mountain gorillas. It's so overpopulated, though. It's got a president who, on one level, has been a very, very good man for Uganda, because after the horrific dictator Idi Amin, he brought peace to the country, and he's wanted to develop it. Unfortunately, he has the mistaken notion, and I met with some of the people in his government who just shake their heads over this. He has the mistaken notion that China and India's prosperity is directly proportional to their large populations, and he wants Uganda's population to double, so he's also against family planning. However, in the area around the mountain gorilla country, people have come to realize that the sheer pressure of their presence is, even if they try not to touch the gorillas themselves, if they try to, to put fences around the parks, there are so many of them that, because humans and gorillas share over 95% of DNA, that human diseases can attack gorillas. And I followed a Ugandan veterinarian, a really brilliant woman, who, after dealing with gorilla diseases, finally realized that the only way that they were going to solve that problem was by instituting family planning. And hundreds and hundreds of villages are now signing on to this to try to lower their population pressure, because mountain gorillas are one of the most important sources of revenue to them in the form of tourist revenue. Niger is one of my worst-case countries, along with Pakistan. Niger is a West African country. It's a Sahel nation. The desertification of the Sahel is making it drier and drier there. So in village after village, I would go go to, they would tell me how there used to be this 10-year drought cycle that then became a 5-year drought cycle. And then when I was there, they were in a 3-year drought cycle, and it already lasted 4 years. And every village, 150, 200 kids had died. And they have the highest, both the highest infant mortality and the highest birth rate of any country. Women typically have 7 or 8 children, and they've had many more who have died on them. They're always trying to stay ahead of the Grim Reaper, but it's just a zero-sum business now because their crop harvests are diminishing, their cattle are dying. I was in one village, my book is a series of stories, and I'm sort of the unseen narrator in them. But in one village, like many other villages I went to, they said to me, if you had been here 25 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to see that house 100 meters away because there were so many trees here. I said, so what happened to the trees? And they said, well, people just cut them for firewood, and there were so many of us cutting them, and then the weather changed on us, and they asked me at what point, did I have any advice for them? I said, I don't really have any advice. I'm just a journalist, but I do have some observations. I said, if your cattle and your children are dying because you have less water and you don't have as much food, have you thought about family planning? And, this was in a meeting of the inauguration of the new mayor, and all the men were sitting under this portico, and all the women were kind of surrounding. And so when I said that, and it was translated, all the women kind of leaned in, and all the men started laughing because they said, well, don't you realize that each of us has about 3 or 4 wives? And the mayor himself had 33 children. And I said, well, yes, I do understand. You've been doing this always in your world, in your culture, and my culture started out the same way as polygamists. But at some point, the world has changed on you, and maybe this is a time, that you have to think about changing things. And that caused a great deal of consternation among the men. But the Sultan, who was present, said, we must be thinking about new ways.
Good. At least there was some leadership thought about it. Ellen, we're going to take a very quick break here and come right back to you.
Sure.
Remind our listeners that we're listening to KWMR Community Radio for West Marin in Point Reyes Station in Bolinas. We're on FM 90.5 in Point Reyes Station and FM 89.9 in Bolinas. And we're streaming live at kwmr.org. This is Post Carbon Radio with Bernie Steffen and Bing Gong, and today our guest is Alan Weissman. He's the author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth.
Let's start off. How many people can our planet sustain? What is its carrying capacity?
Well, there are a couple of different measures of that by different scientists in my book. One made a calculation in the 1990s that still holds pretty true today, trying to figure out the amount of fossil energy that we could keep burning without overwhelming our atmosphere and our seas' ability to absorb and dangerously change their chemistry. And also trying to distribute that amount of energy equitably amongst people in the world, so most people would have access to an acceptable lifestyle, say something more like a European lifestyle, which people are much less energy profligate than we are here in the United States, and yet it's a lifestyle that we would probably accept and that most Africans and South Indians would be pleased to have. And that calculation came down to somewhere between 1.5 billion, which was our population in 1900, and 3 billion, depending on how you cut it. And interestingly enough, that scientist is today Barack Obama's science advisor, John Holdren, who used to be a physicist at Berkeley. I am hoping that President Obama is paying attention to him because he's a brilliant scientist, and you can go on the White House. House's Office of Science and Technology page and see some real wisdom about the situation that our atmosphere is in. Another calculation has to do with food production. We can't keep poisoning ourselves. It's not just us. The nitrogen fertilizer, which is, first of all, it's made from fossil fuels, both as its base and the energy it takes to make the stuff, and then when it breaks down, it turns into nitrous oxide, which after methane is our third most potent greenhouse gas. So nitrogen oxide is screwing up the, or nitrogen fertilizer is screwing up the atmosphere. It sterilizes soils. It contaminates rivers downstream from our fields, and it leaves chunks of the ocean at the mouth of the world's great rivers, the size of New Jersey, basically dead. After the Aswan Dam was built on the Nile, and before the Nile used to just bring all this nutritious silt down and flood the fields alongside the river in Egypt and fertilize them that way. But after the dam, they had to start using artificial fertilizer. And a little more than 5 years later, the fish catch in the Mediterranean was down by about 50%. So this is crazy. All the poisons that we use to protect our technologically developed plants are now, coming back to bite us. I mean, the idea that we can create poisons that selectively just go after species that we don't like, but leave ones that we do like alone, including ourselves, is crazy. And now scientists and doctors are connecting the dots between the rising rates of autism, cognitive disorders, cancers, to the poisons and the agricultural hormones that we have in our food system. Before artificial nitrogen was commercialized, there were about 2 billion of us on this planet living off of the energy and the natural nutrients that nature provided in its natural cycle. And I think that's a number that we can shoot for, but I'm not suggesting that we cull anybody alive. I'm not suggesting that we get rid of medical technology. I mean, look, any of us over 40 wouldn't be here without it. But there are things that we can do to gradually, over the next few decades, the next couple of generations, bring ourselves down to a sustainable level.
We may be getting help with the idea that peak oil is indeed the cost of further fossil fuel extraction keeps going up, and we're getting to a point of diminishing energy availability based on the energy we can put into it.
Well, that's probably true, but these people are not giving up trying.
I know.
And they're trying to blow up the bedrock here.
Yep.
It just came from Europe, and they're trying to do the same thing there to try to squeeze every single hydrocarbon out from.
Unfortunately, that's true, but it just shows that they're having to go to more costly means and more extreme means. So I'm suggesting there might be some hope in the peak oil phenomenon. I think that as well, we need to get leaders, as you were pointing out, to become understanding of these consequences, because you mentioned religious leaders. We now have Pope Francis, head of the Catholic Church.
Well, Pope Francis can't change anything.
No, but it's changing.
Guys, forget about this one. The Catholic Church is painted into a corner on this issue. And when they lost all their territory, and they basically lost all their power, so they had to come up with something really quickly to be powerful. So they invented the concept of papal infallibility. It didn't exist before. And then, because they wanted to keep being fruitful and multiply, have more Catholics, they opposed contraception. Well, in the 1960s, when the pill was invented, John the 23rd appointed a commission to study the issue, because women started bleeding off to the evangelical Protestants, who were saying, "What, your church thinks that you're a sinner because you want to be responsible and have only the number of children that you can properly take care of? Our church loves you for that." So the commission eventually, it was both lay and pastoral, they eventually voted 69-10 to legalize contraception under the church. But an opinion was filed by a very bright Polish bishop who later became pointed out that if they legalize contraception in the church, there were going to be two really serious problems. One is that they would be admitting that for the past century they had been mistakenly condemning innocents as sinners, that they were wrong and the Protestants had been right all along. And second, if they admitted to a mistake, that meant the popes weren't infallible after all, because if one pope's infallible, they all have to be. So they can't change.
Well, I'm not giving up some hope for Francis, because he's already shown me that he's not necessarily in the mold of the rest. But
well, if you were a woman, you would have noticed that he's already said he's not going to ordain them.
Yeah, no, I understand that part. I do. And I know that they're drawing the line at abortion, but I think on contraception there's hope, primarily because, and I think you point out in your book, the Italian women, for example, who are very Catholic, have already, and maybe throughout the world, women are recognizing to take this power in their own hands.
Look, that has nothing to do with Francis. This was happening long before he was there. But you're right. You know, I was just in Spain all last week on book tour, and in Spain and Italy, women's reproduction rate is way below replacement. That's two people having two children replacing themselves. And let me tell you a little story, a very hopeful story, about the reason why that happened. But I'm going to detour to an Islamic country to explain it. In 1979, Iran had its Islamic revolution, and they were attacked immediately thereafter by Saddam Hussein, who tried to grab this oil-rich province on their border. He figured the country was disorganized. With a change of regime, it would be easy pickings. And he also had the backing of NATO, so he had technological weapons, and he had even the ingredients for nerve gas, which he was happy to use. All Iran had was bodies. So the Ayatollah asked every fertile Iranian woman to do her patriotic duty and get pregnant to help create a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders. Well, 8 years later, the war finally ended in a truce, and the visionary economist who was the head of the budget for Iran realized that they had a problem. He basically told the Ayatollah that within 15, 20 years, these kids were going to need jobs, and it was going to be just like Pakistan is today. You know, the country would become destabilized with all these frustrated, unemployed young men. So the Ayatollah blessed the idea of family planning. In fact, just as Khomeini died, in today's Ayatollah Khamenei came in, Khamenei's, one of his first acts was a fatwa that said there's nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates you've got the number of children that you can properly care for, there's nothing against any kind of contraception from withdrawal all the way up to operations for males and females. They also made all of these forms available throughout the country. There's a woman in my book, Countdown, a very devout Muslim woman, who's also an obstetrician, that told me about being on these surgical teams that would go horseback to the farthest villages, bringing contraceptives and operations to anybody who wanted them. The only thing that was obligatory was for couples to attend premarital classes, in which they would learn, among other things, how much does it cost to, you know, raise, feed, clothe, and educate children. And then the fourth thing was that they encourage girls to stay in school. Because when a girl is studying, she postpones her pregnancies until after her studies are through. And once they are through, she's got something interesting and useful to do with her life, but it's impossible to do that when you've got seven kids hanging on you. So rich country, poor country.
Yeah.
Islamic country, Catholic country. I mean, you know, Italy and Spain have the highest percentages of women with graduate degrees in the world. But you just get a girl beyond high school, and the average number of children that she will have in her lifetime is two or fewer. Iran today has 60% of its university students are female, and they came down to replacement rate a year faster than China with its draconian one-child policy.
I think it's great that you've learned these things and have written about them. I mean, Iran setting example. Very few people in this country would expect that. I was curious, how do they deal with abortion?
Well, Abortion is an open secret in Iran. It's illegal, but anybody with any money can get one. You know, I asked a lot about it in North Iran. In fact, that devout Muslim, OBGYN, who I talked to, there's a great story about her in the book where she does not do abortions herself. She is personally against abortion because of her religion. But she has gone to Parliament and she has argued to legalize abortion in the country, because she knows that, you know, sometimes birth control methods fail, and sometimes, you know, women just don't have access to them. All over the world, there are 40 million abortions a year. They happen just as much in countries where it's illegal as countries where it's legal. And several different demographic institutions have studied this and determined that if contraception were universally available in the world, I mean, right now nearly a quarter billion women do not have access to contraception, and as we know here in the United States, people are trying to even restrict it more. But if it were universally available, instead of 40 million abortions a year, we'd have 14 million. Now that's still a lot of abortions if you're against abortion, but saving 36 million abortions per year, that's the best anti-abortion program that I know of.
Let's look at China again, the one-child policy. Could you give us a little more meat to that?
Yeah, it's been nearly a month in China. It's interesting that on the one hand, the Chinese policy has been very successful in two ways. One, there'd be 400 million more Chinese today if they hadn't gone through it. And I traveled a lot with scientists from the Chinese National Academy of Science who were showing me these environmental mitigation programs, the most expensive ones in the world. They're trying to put back 40 million trees. They're spending $40 billion to put back millions and millions of trees that were cut during China's population explosion. And it also helped mitigate the fact that 40 million Chinese approximately died in the world's worst famine before they instituted that policy. And we've learned a lot about some of the bad things that can happen with such a draconian policy. You know, female babies being abandoned, sex preference, abortions, because at the time China was a rural country and people wanted sons to help work on the farm and they wanted more kids, you know, for manual labor. What's going on today is that China's building incredible numbers of cities. There's over 150 of a million or more, and there'll be 250 by the middle of the 2020s. In urban areas, people don't need as many babies, because babies aren't economically helpful to the family. In fact, kids just cost a lot of money. So even though they've recently relaxed the policy, it's kind of symbolic, because it means that people who are an only child can have more than one, but the overwhelming majority are going to have one child because they don't have very much space, and it costs a lot. But an interesting thing that's happening is that before, male was the preferred child, but now as it comes down to having a couple of, you know, like four grandparents and two parents and only one child down there at the bottom who someday may be helping to take care of them in their old age, turns out that girls are much more attentive. So suddenly girl children are becoming much more prized.
Mm-hmm. Alan, can we move on to Japan? I know they're... the demographic is aging, and they have real low fertility rates.
Well, Japan has a low fertility rate, and it actually has a shrinking population now for sort of a historical, exceptional reason. After World War II, which, by the way, was a war that Japan got into because they were overpopulated and they wanted to invade Manchuria and expand their territory, and then they just got too greedy and they kept going. they lost that war, and after the war, their soldiers came home like ours and, you know, commenced with their wives again. And immediately, the population jumped by 10 million people. But having lost the war, their economy was in ruins, and suddenly, people were starving. Japanese women who were pregnant were literally throwing themselves in front of trains rather than watch another baby die of hunger. So an emergency measure in 1949, Japan legalized abortion. Remember, this was before the pill. And millions of Japanese women partook. So now, as that last big overgrown generation that was born before World War II begins to die off, there's a much smaller generation to replace them. And because of the high educational level, those women have fewer children. So Japan's population has now turned the corner, and it's starting to fall, and it's going to fall rather dramatically during the next half century. Little after 2050, they're going to be nearing their World War II population again. And many economists are terrified about that because, you know, we hear from economists that, we have to grow always, and pro-growth economists love big populations. You know, they tell you that there's more consumers, but mainly the dirty secret that they don't like to admit is that they like big populations because that keeps the price of labor down. They want a lot of poor people fighting themselves over, you know, willing to accept miserable salaries. And it's just simply unfair. What they neglect to tell us is that older people today, with today's health, after 65, remain economically productive for quite a while, whereas kids, until they're near in 20, don't really add much to the economy. They cost the economy an awful lot. There's going to be, in the transition in Japan, a generation and a half, where there's going to be a bubble of a large population, but then the young ones and the older ones are going to start evening out. And I follow in the book these young people now who are moving into the countryside. As a very visionary Japanese economist named Akihiko Matsutani told me, Japan is now heading in the direction of sustainability. And this guy's no radical. He's part of a major policy institute. But what he says is happening is that as the hinterlands become abandoned, this older generation dies off, young people realize that there's no need to live in these crowded big cities where everything's so expensive. And, you know, they're all port cities because they import a lot of raw materials to manufacture goods. There's land and housing available for cheap, and light industry is following them because what happens as population drops is that there are fewer workers, so they're more valuable, so their wages don't drop. Eventually, Matsutani explained, national per capita income, gross national product, will drop nationally, but per capita income doesn't because people keep earning the same amount. He said there'll be fewer needs for fewer goods with fewer people, which means that with our technological advances in the industries, we're going to have more leisure time to enjoy more space in this world. And that, to me, sounds like a livable future.
It's a very hopeful story, this Japan analysis that you give. I mean, we witnessed
that my book is a bestseller in Japan, so that the word is spreading.
Yeah, we, of course, witnessed the Fukushima and now the people having to decide whether their energy is going to be nuclear or what else and how. But the idea that they're embracing a overall economic either stability or coming down and focusing more on the individual economic benefit and not this total gross national product, which is what is having this big adverse impact all over the globe.
Well, it's, you know, believe me, not without a fight. I was interviewed by Japan's top business magazine while I was there, and it was just a couple months after Fukushima, and this guy asked me, he says, well, don't you think it's hysterical that people are demanding an end to nuclear energy? And I said, well, you know, given that all your nuke plants are on coastlines vulnerable to tsunamis or on top of geologic faults. I wouldn't call that hysteria. He said, yeah, but without nuclear energy, production is going to drop. I mean, isn't it hysterical not to take that into account? And he kept rephrasing the question until about, hoping for a better answer until about the fourth time before I could answer. The hotel that we were sitting in Tokyo shook as a tremor struck, and it was no longer necessary for me to reply.
Well, I like that you take this whole impact into account as front and center, because when your book is about population, one of the things that comes to my mind right away, well, it's not just population, but the level of consumption. So people say we have more of a consumption problem, and you relate that to the affluence and the technology, and really put out that equation that some other folks, I guess, have developed, is that, you know, the impact is ultimately a function of the population times their affluence times whatever technology they're employing.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like to hear this, but when people talk about consumption being the problem and all we have to do is develop the will to reduce consumption, they're stuck in the same fantasy as anybody who says that all the solutions are market-driven, because consumption, lowering consumption is a market-driven market-driven solution. The idea that we just change it by changing our habits. Look, we're not going to change our habits because, you know, people can feel good about driving Priuses or using compact fluorescents or trying to drive bicycles, and they should be doing that. I'm totally in favor of it. I try to do it myself. But the fact is, every one of us alive is addicted to concentrated energy. Nobody who's listening to your program doesn't have electricity. Everybody's driving around in some kind of vehicle that is adding carbon dioxide. And people tell me, oh, yeah, but, you know, the population increases in the poor countries and they use so much less than the United States. Well, on the one hand, yeah, they're right. To really understand population, you have to multiply the number of people by their consumptive habits, which makes us the most overpopulated country on Earth. It means that every country's got to lower its population. But the poorest countries I went to, people need fuel, people need all that space. I mean, by occupying 40% of the world to feed ourselves, that means that we are pushing other species off the edge of the earth. And eventually, you know, we evolved with that biodiversity. Eventually, we're going to get rid of something that we didn't know that we needed until it's too late. As the famous ecologist Paul Ehrlich said to me, he said, look, there's just no condom for consumption yet.
I think may have to be sort of our ending here.
Well, I have to state that there is a condom for this. This is technology that we have, and it would be extremely cheap. Universal contraception would cost less per year, about $8.1 billion for the whole world, than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan. We can afford to do this.
Fabulous.
We've been talking to Alan Weissman, author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Go to Point Reyes Books to order this book and get enlightened on what's happening around the world. We want to thank you very much, Alan Weissman, for being our guest today.
It's been a pleasure. You live in a beautiful part of the world. Keep it that way.
Well, thank you so much, and keep up the good work. You're doing wonderful work with what you're reporting.